Welcome to the Practically Perfect Parenting Podcast. I'm Sarah Polinchek. I'm here with my co-host,
John Summers Flanagan. Hello, Sarah. How are you this morning?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good.
So the title of today's episode is Teens and Depression. This is a really important episode, I think, because it's a little confusing. There's a lot of ways that we describe teenagers, and some of those ways can be typical way to describe a teenager, and some of those ways can be indicative of something more serious and concerning, which is depression.
Right. You know, I remember that early on there were some theories that children and teenagers couldn't actually suffer from clinical depression. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we know that that is not true, that they do suffer from this diagnosable condition, mm-hmm. often called major depressive disorder or dysthymic disorder. Those are the two most common forms of clinical depression.
Yeah. You know, before we get started, I think it's important for our listeners to know that this is also one of your specialties. I know you speak around the country on this topic, and so I think it's just a special privilege that you're able to speak on this today, and I'm going to be asking you some questions. And the first one is, when do we know what behavior is normal and when we should be concerned? I mean, that word normal is a little tricky, but...
You know, I think it's really hard. The diagnostic criteria for depression in teenagers is almost exactly the same as it is for depression in adults. For major depressive disorder, there are 9 specific symptoms, 5 of which would have to be present. And at least, at minimum, there has to be the existence of a depressed mood. Now, in teenagers, it also could be an irritable mood that can substitute for a depressed or sad mood. So it has to be a sad, depressed, or irritable mood, or what we call anhedonia, which is the not experiencing pleasure in what's usually pleasurable.
Okay, so how do we know? You know, I mean, if our son or daughter is acting a little more irritable, how do we know the difference between, gosh, this is something where, you know, teenagers just act irritable sometimes, or this is something where I need to take some action and be a little more concerned?
Right. We recently had a show on when teens talk back, mm-hmm. right? And one of the things that's natural is for teens to be seeking independence. And sometimes they can be pretty irritable about that as mm-hmm. well. And so I think your question is really good. And it's hard to make a distinction sometimes between sort of the normal emotional moodiness and irritability mm-hmm. of a teenager, especially when they're unhappy with you as a parent, versus a more significant clinical situation where they are depressed. And so a couple of things I would say. Mm-hmm. One is it a significant change from a previous level of functioning? In other words, were they more cheerful, more involved, and less irritable? And then suddenly, boom, you see a significant change. That's an important characteristic to watch for. That's, I know, not a perfect solution. Another thing is that is there social withdrawal or withdrawal from the things that your teenager used to engage in and enjoy. Okay, and that's sort of one of those hallmark things that if there's not enjoyment from those things that the teenager used to enjoy, there could be some problems with clinical depression.
Okay, and are we watching for how long this lasts, too?
Absolutely. The minimum for major depressive disorder is 2 weeks. And so you have to have the symptoms present for 2 weeks.
Okay.
You can also have a more mild and chronic form of depression called dysthymic disorder, and that has to last at least a year.
Okay.
And usually that form often involves lowered self-esteem. And that can be true for major depressive disorder, and the two overlap a lot. And it's very complicated. And if you are significantly concerned, so Sarah, if you came to me and you were concerned about whether your child was depressed or not, I would say, you know, go see a professional. Mm-hmm. And I probably would lean toward go see a clinical psychologist or a licensed counselor or a licensed social worker. But you certainly can go to a physician as well. One of my reservations about going directly to a physician about depressive symptoms is that the usual outcome there is a pill. Mm-hmm. And I have a little bias against that because a pill is not a skill.
I knew you were going to say that.
And So, and the research on antidepressants is sort of mixed, and I know you're going to ask me about that, aren't you?
Yeah. Okay, John. Talk to us a little bit about medications. So I have a parent, let's say, and it's been about a month, and their kid is no longer wanting to play their music after school. Let's say they used to play the trumpet, and they don't want to play the music after school. They're not reading books. They're not engaging with friends, and they're really, really grouchy. And it's been going on for a month, which is a lot different than it used to be.
Okay. Now I'm going to put on my balanced and objective cap right now, putting it on, because sometimes I will be a little against antidepressant medications, and one of the reasons, one of my rationales for that is that they get promoted so much in our culture that I want to try to push back.
Okay.
But antidepressant medications are not all bad. Basically, there's not a ton of evidence to suggest that they're highly effective with teenagers who are depressed. Now, that said, there can be some very significant individual responders. In other words, some teenagers will respond really well to antidepressant medications. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is we don't know if it's really the antidepressant medication or what we call the placebo effect, because those two things overlap a lot. And in fact, most of the studies on antidepressant medications with youth suggests that the placebo is just as effective as antidepressants, which is sort of confusing. But in the real world, I've seen, and I bet you've seen too, some individual teenagers who respond really well to antidepressants, but as a blanket solution, as it's just not a first-line treatment.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I'll think through my Rolodex of teens where I know it has been very successful. They've gone through and tried lots of other things first.
Right. So right. And that's... so my emphasis would be, and even though you can go see a physician, just be forewarned, they might go quickly to the idea of antidepressant medications. The research just doesn't support that as first-line treatment. Instead, you should think about counseling, psychotherapy, and there are a variety of forms of counseling and psychotherapy that have been shown to be effective in treating depressive symptoms in teenagers.
Okay. All right. So talk a little bit more about this chemical imbalance.
You know, I've got some buttons, Sarah, and the chemical imbalance word is one of the buttons for me.
Okay, it's good to know your buttons.
It's really just a metaphor, probably used more by the pharmaceutical industry to sort of give people a rationale for why antidepressant medications might be effective. There's really no evidence that a true chemical imbalance exists. It's a hypothesis, and it's not one that's been very well supported by the scientific literature. And so when people use the chemical imbalance phrase, I just sort of want to roll my eyes back.
A little contempt?
A little. And so now, again, some people are benefited from thinking about it that way. It's a metaphor. It's not. I mean, if for example, if you speak Spanish and I don't, we have different electrochemical balances in our brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's really very unique. Our brains are more unique than a thumbprint on a snowflake, is what I would like to say. It's our brains are very unique, and so to be able to say, well, mine's out of balance, it's really tough to say.
Okay. I have more questions for you.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about the black box warning?
Yes. The black box warning is something that was established by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And it's a warning that SSRI antidepressant medications, and those are serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors, like Zoloft and Paxil and Prozac, those are some of the classics, so that those medications can increase suicidality in teenagers and young adults and children. And the issue is the research is a little bit unclear in terms of whether it increases suicide rates, but what it does is it increases agitation and a thing they call akathisia, and it increases suicidal behavior. So cutting, suicide attempts tend to happen a little more often in about 2 to 5% of the young people who are prescribed an SSRI antidepressant. So they put a black box label on there warning people that this could be a side effect.
And if I'm a listener, I have to ask, why would that be? Why would I take a medication to prevent, you know, suicidal behavior, right? And improve mm-hmm. my mood and make me feel better. And then it might lead me to being more destructive. I mean, what?
Yeah, it's really confusing. I would say that generally speaking, I think the research data would suggest that if you are depressed and not suicidal, or if you're not depressed, that taking an SSRI antidepressant could increase your suicidality. Okay. Hmm. There was one study of 20 college students who were given Zoloft. They had no history of depression. Two of them were hospitalized for suicidality. Hmm. Okay. So if you don't have symptoms of suicidality or depression and you take an SSRI, it's more likely probably that it's going to increase suicidality. On the other hand, to make it more confusing, if somebody already is suicidal, it appears that the antidepressants may have a protective effect and may decrease the person's suicidality.
Mm-hmm.
So,
this
very
is
complicated.
Hairy, right? And so we wouldn't want to go into it just without lots of consideration. So some kids are going to benefit from it, but we don't want to just apply it. I think my kid's depressed. Let's get him on medication.
It's not a quick fix,
right.
And it's certainly not a quick fix for the majority of young people who are experiencing depression. Let me tell you, the first study ever that was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, highly scientific study on an antidepressant in children. And
okay.
It's the first one of its kind because before 1982, all the studies were just give somebody antidepressants and give teenagers antidepressants or children antidepressants and then see how they respond.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you give them a placebo, they tend to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And so they hadn't sorted that out. So they took half of the kids diagnosed as having major depressive disorder, gave them an antidepressant. The other half, they gave placebo pills. It was double blind, so the people even giving the pills didn't know
mm-hmm.
who got the real medication.
Right, they weren't influencing their subjects.
Or right. The sugar pill.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
As it turns out, 45% of the kids who got an antidepressant recovered, no longer qualified as having major depressive disorder.
Well, that sounds good.
That's pretty good, mm-hmm. 45%.
Mm-hmm. I have a feeling you have a follow-up.
69%. Of the children in the placebo group recovered and no longer qualified for the diagnosis of depression.
Okay. So 45% who received the medication got better, but 69% who got a placebo got better.
Got better.
Wow, that's a big thing to remember.
It's a big thing to remember.
Yeah.
And that makes it really difficult, even for pharmaceutical companies who try their best to show that their medications are effective or efficacious, makes it really hard to prove that.
Okay.
Because the placebo response is so significant and powerful.
Okay. So we're not saying never, ever, and no, but we're saying put a yellow light and have some caution and that there are other things to try first.
Right.
Okay. So what about combination treatment?
You know, a lot of people you'll hear, and I've read some of the studies, but you'll hear many people say, well, the best thing is a combination of an antidepressant plus counseling or psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, turns out that's not really the case. There's not really good scientific evidence to support that.
Okay.
It's a reasonable idea, and it may well be the best in a particular situation. But in general, the scientific evidence doesn't support that. It would say first-line treatment, therapy. Okay?
Okay.
That's the best thing. What kind of therapy? Cognitive behavioral therapy. Maybe interpersonal psychotherapy for
mm-hmm.
depression.
Mm-hmm.
Some really good research on that. It's a particular approach to therapy that focuses on relationships. And so for teenagers, it tends to be pretty effective.
Mm-hmm.
A thing called behavioral activation therapy for depression, which mostly involves getting out and doing things that are positively reinforcing and getting the kid reengaged in life.
Mm-hmm.
Family therapy is a really good approach for treating depression because oftentimes it's the dysfunctional family patterns that are contributing to the teenager having more and more depressive thoughts and feelings.
In some cases, yeah. So what do you do if a teen seems to be struggling, but they're saying, no way, I'm not going to talk to some weirdo in some office and tell them all about my life?
Well, what I would say as a caring and concerned parent is then you give your teenager choices.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so one choice is to go for counseling with a woman therapist. Another choice is to go to counseling with a man therapist. Mm-hmm. Another choice is for you to enroll in a cardio exercise program at our local YMCA mm-hmm. and to go. And I say that partly because of the research evidence on cardio exercise, as well as yoga mm-hmm. and weightlifting, all those forms of exercise, but cardio probably has the best evidence, has an antidepressant effect. Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm just going to add one more thing, too. I think for parents who are listening to this and thinking, oh, gosh, I don't know. I am a little worried about my child, but I'm not so sure we need to go to family therapy. I don't mm-hmm. know. I think it's acceptable for a parent to go meet with a counselor themselves without their teen and get a consultation. You know, these are the things I'm worried about, and talk that out with somebody, right, before they go insist that, hey, you have to come with me and...
So I'm really glad that you mentioned that because mm-hmm. That is a great first step. Mm-hmm. If you're concerned, make an appointment with a professional yourself and go talk and consult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in that menu of choices that I would give the teenager, I would include family therapy. You know, mm-hmm. we're not just wanting to blame you for feeling mm-hmm. bad. The whole family can go, mm-hmm. right? And there are various other kind of non-drug approaches. I mean, there's the light box therapy. Mm-hmm. Is it highly effective in many cases? Well, not always, but it does have some efficacy also. And so if people are living in northern or far southern climates where you're not getting a lot of sun, it could be that there's a seasonal component to the depressive symptoms, and having a little light box therapy,
definitely
put that on your menu of things mm-hmm. if it seems reasonable. You know, almost always some engagement or involvement in positive social environments is good. So you could put on a list some involvement in community or church activities, volunteering at Humane Society, or getting a pet. And, you know, there are a lot of things you can do outside of formal counseling and psychotherapy that can help reduce depressive symptoms. I would put those on the list at least at first, and you mm-hmm. can try and have your teenager try some of the less invasive things first. And certainly you can put medications on that list too, because there may be some teenagers who would say, I'd way rather take a pill than go talk to somebody. You know, some people are just therapy averse. They just don't want to go.
Sure. And what I like about that too is this menu of choices is it really gives a teenager agency in their own life, and they mm-hmm. should have agency. This is a big deal. So this isn't something where we want to force them to do. We definitely want to be supporting them to do something, but we're not going to force them into one category. And giving them that agency, I think, is appropriate at this age.
Yeah. And I'd say, you said do something, and that's really the recommendation. Mm-hmm. Partly because what we know about clinical depression is if you ignore it, it does go away. The problem is if you ignore it and you don't get any kind of intervention for it, you don't get counseling or psychotherapy or family therapy or some kind of intensive exercise or medications. You don't get anything for it. It tends to come back more frequently, last longer, and be more intense. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of set up and, you know, just for a cycle of increasing episodes of depression if you just ignore it.
I think that's really important for us all to know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So are we ready for some advice?
I think we're ready for some money tips.
Okay. What's yours?
You know, mine is exercise. And I know that's a big surprise.
We sound so healthy, right?
We sound healthy.
And sorry.
You know, one of the reasons I like exercise, especially for teenagers, is that, and I'm now, right now, in this moment, blanking on the name of the study, but there was a pretty small study, about 30 students in a high school who were all diagnosed as having major depressive disorder. So mm-hmm. they were pretty substantially depressed. And what they did was they just put them all on an exercise program. Now, one of the exclusion criteria was that it could not be a student in the high school who already was doing a regular cardio exercise okay. program. And they gave them heart rate monitors, and they tracked, and then they had to sort of do a certain number of minutes a day and a certain number of minutes a week. Can't remember the exact numbers, but this is a fabulous study in that they could do whatever they wanted. They could do that Wii kind of video interactive computer-based thing. They could go for walks. They could do some kind of aerobics class. They could do whatever they wanted. They just had to get their heart rate up
yeah.
for a certain number of minutes per week per day.
Okay.
100% effectiveness. Now, no control group. Okay, so it's not a super highly scientifically generalizable study. Mm-hmm. But to me, if you have a kid who's not exercising and who has symptoms of depression, cardio.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to ask you a tough question.
Okay.
I'm imagining a kid who's depressed. They're laying around a lot, playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to go tell this kid, hey, get on the treadmill? It's good for you. You know, I mean, that just seems really hard.
I think it would be terribly hard, but this is one time when you need to be a persistent parent.
And be creative, probably.
Be creative. I think there are ways that they can maybe get rewards of video games if they do their cardio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like you can have dessert if you eat your vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can weave that into the family life. It's going to take some push.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing in this particular study was they had sort of an outside consultant who they could contact by phone or who they had regular contact and support from. And so it might be good to find somebody outside of the family to also support this exercise plan or program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't want to do too much too soon because somebody's going to get sore muscles and it's going to be an aversive experience and
right.
They're not going
to
want to continue.
Yeah.
So you want to start slow and you want to start with something that's fun or interesting for them. And maybe watching a certain show while they're on the treadmill could pair up a little screen time.
Sure.
As well as exercise. And maybe doing that, you know, some of those virtual reality things
right.
That have become more popular,
mm-hmm.
Those could be ways to make it more fun. Or walking that dog. I understand
mm-hmm.
you have a dog that needs walking.
Mm-hmm. Regularly.
Walking the neighbor's dog.
Yeah, those are good ideas. I just think we don't want to underestimate that it could be really challenging.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. And if you can't accomplish that, probably time to pull in a professional.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I'm going to talk about sleep again. Surprise, surprise. So it's a little more complicated, though, when we're talking about teens who have depression, because sometimes it's not that they're not sleeping enough. You know, we were just talking in a previous episode about the average teen is getting about 7.5 hours of sleep, but sometimes teens who are depressed are sleeping, you know, upwards of 12, 13 hours. I mean, that can be a thing too.
Right.
So really what we want to talk about is appropriate sleep hygiene. And one of the examples I'm thinking of, I'm thinking about a particular teen that I've consulted with who was staying up until 2 and 3 in the morning playing video games that were in their room. And then, you know, obviously not able to get up and go to school, and on weekends sleeping until 2 and 3 in the afternoon. And that's just not the kind of sleep hygiene that is going to promote, you know, healthy emotional states, right? So we really have to work hard to get on a good sleep hygiene schedule. And one of the big things I would say is to remove entertainment from the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what they say, only 2 things should happen in a bedroom. Can we say them?
You can say them.
So sex and sleep.
Yeah.
Now, we're not promoting that our teens are going to have sex right now in their bedroom, so it's just
yeah.
sleep, right, for
yeah.
teens, okay? So we really just want to make sure. I mean, that's just a big thing, I think, is to get the
mm-hmm.
technology and the entertainment out
mm-hmm.
And to encourage our teens to go to sleep by 9 or 10 at night, which probably sounds ludicrous to some people
mm-hmm.
who are set in a routine of going to sleep much, much later, but it's an important, crucial piece.
Right. I think you pitch sleep so well that I'm convinced it's the right thing to do.
Good.
You also mentioned a couple of things. One is the idea of oversleeping too much. That's hypersomnia can be a symptom of depression.
Mm-hmm.
And then insomnia is also a symptom of depression.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
I like your focus on sleep hygiene as the solution. One other factor to think about, if your teenager is having consistently disrupted sleep, one of the other things that creates sleep disruption is trauma. Okay, so there may be some trauma, and it may be that you need to have some counseling or therapy focusing on trauma in order to help make sleep become more possible.
That sounds good. Okay.
We're winding down.
We are, yes. Do you have some resources?
I do. Yeah. You know, there are a lot, and teen depression is a big deal, so there are lots and lots of books out there. I'm going to mention one. It's called The Antidepressant Book. It's not about antidepressant medications. It's about all non-drug or non-medical interventions. It's called The Antidepressant Book, A Practical Guide for Teens and Young Adults to Overcome Depression and Stay Healthy. It's written by Jacob Towery, and I recommend it. It's not going to be the solution for everybody, but it probably has some good ideas and resources that might at least be worth considering.
Okay. Well, and I have one too. It's called Beyond the Blues, A Workbook to Help Teens Overcome Depression. This is by Lisa Schaub. It's got a lot of really good reviews. And again, I just think we want to give our parents choices for some of these resources. And I think we both agree that one of our favorites is to find a good consultant in the community to talk to first, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so this is a good time for us to say thank you to the National Parenting Education Network. Mm-hmm. They can be a consultant or a resource because it's a group of parenting educators. Mm-hmm. And so it's at npen.org. They're one of our sponsors. And so you can find some information there. And then we also want to thank the Charles Engelhardt Foundation, as always, for supporting and underwriting this Practically Perfect Parenting podcast.
Excellent. Thank you so much. The Practically Perfect Parenting Podcast is sponsored in part by the Charles Engelhardt Foundation, audio engineer Mike Matthews, production assistant Joey Moore, and co-hosts Sarah Polinchek and John Summers Flanagan.